ESPN 107.3 presents Wild at Heart, bringing outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond. Wild at Heart, powered by Cowtown USA, Colton Steakhouse and Grill, J. Cook Fly Rods, The Outdoor Superstore, Advanced Performance Shooting, Missouri Trappers Association, and Trout and Sons. Now, Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM and the pulse of the Ozarks, beautiful Rolla, Missouri. I'm your host, Tommy Bench. Jerry Cook is my co-host, and Thomas Maples is our radio engineer. Welcome to Wild at Heart. We're red-blooded Americans who remember and cherish our outdoor heritage. We love America and support the Second Amendment. We stand for our national anthem, say please and thank you, and open doors for the ladies. We hunt, fish, trap, shoot, float, camp, and explore in God's country, the Missouri Ozarks, right out your back door and occasionally a few points beyond. Join us each Wednesday at 4 p.m. right here on ESPN 107.3 FM, or catch us Sundays at 8 a.m. or anytime online at ESPN1073.com. This segment of Wild Heart is brought to you by J. Cook Fly Rods, custom fly rods plus everything you need for fly fishing, located in downtown St. James. We're starting a show off today with Justin Travis and Josh Cornelison, who both finished up the USA Bassin season with the championship, and we're just going to talk about the season they had. You know, the week by week or the tournament by tournament, and how they were able to essentially seal the deal and win the championship over a pretty stacked field. So, welcome to the show, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Josh, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I just want to make sure you can hear me all right. But So what do you guys think? You know, when you first started, I know you guys fished a series about 5, 6, 7 years ago. I don't remember. It was the same series, USA Bassin, but you both had got into it just like, hey, we're gonna fish this series for the heck of it. And you guys won that series as well. And I don't think you fished since then until this year, have you?
I haven't. That was 2013, the spring. Lake of the Ozarks Division.
Spring 2013.
Yes, that was the first year USA Bassin had their tournaments on Lake of the Ozarks.
There's some pretty good guys that fish some tournaments out there. I know Jim Young, you guys were kind of neck and neck with, or not neck and neck, you guys ended up having to fend him off, you know, so to speak. He was right behind you in points, and he's known to be. I know that when I first met Jim Young, Bob Rankin, he introduced me to him, and he said, here's one of the local hammers around here is Jim Young. And I didn't know that at the time, but obviously he's got a name reputation around there.
Yeah, yeah. He had won 3 years in a row consecutive. That's pretty the past good. 3 years, the championship, and we knocked him off his perch.
Knocked him off his high pedestal, didn't you? That's the way to do it. Oh, J&J, Justin and Josh, come in there. Yep. And laid the hammer down on him. So what was the kind of bite? I mean, I know it's not something you just go out there and say, well, we're just going to throw a jig every tournament, or we're going to do this. You know, everyone, you guys have your strengths, and you fish well together, obviously, and you make good decisions. And in the end, it all works out. It did, particularly this year, and you were consistent, more consistent than anybody else. So what are some of the things you remember in particular? I know the last one was probably memorable, but let's just talk about how – you know, what are some of the key baits you think you used or it took, or what are some key moves you had to do to – do you remember? Do you remember, like, the first tournament or second or third or anything in particular that you that may have been memorable that you had to do something different, or, you know, than anyone else, or just grind it out?
Was really, we depended on one hole that surprisingly held some decent fish for us the whole fall season, except for the last tournament. But – just a couple of spots that we had found that luckily held out for September through the end of November for us.
Yeah, and that was key. You know, like you said, you had a couple of good spots that you were able to keep kind of tight-lipped about, not let everyone else know about, make a community hole. I was just talking to Nathan Oliver about that earlier, and you just can't – certain people, you can't tell. You know, John was telling me that he called me yesterday, and anyway, the point of it is he was talking about how the listeners all want to hear the secrets. They want to hear what you guys did and what you did differently, which everyone does, but you can't give everything away, especially in the middle of a season. But that's pretty good. You guys had those few holes that really that produced for you that you were able to rely on.
Well, and the hardest part about it was we knew the fish were there. And this might sound crazy, but the hardest part was staying committed to it, because anyone that fishes Lake the Ozarks, there's so much dock talk about the current bite, what the fish are doing, what they're throwing. And there's a few tournaments that we were really close to going away from it. And as a team, we made the commitment to it. And that was the biggest decision we made through the whole series, was we committed to what we were doing. When we were in one of the tournaments, probably the only one doing what we were doing. Wow. And it went against everything that you probably should have been doing.
Was you throwing an articulated spinner bait by any chance?
No, it was not. We caught some fish on a spinner bait.
Very few people know what an articulated spinner bait is.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's yes.
We pretty well stuck to the deep brush through the most of it, and the spots that we didn't feel like we're getting hit very, that not a lot of people were probably fishing. And we didn't have the best finishes in the first couple of tournaments, but and the points deal, that just consistency counts. So
it does. No, that's more important than anything else. Consistency is way more important in a series than winning. You know, you may not win every tournament, or any for that fact, but if you're the most consistent team that can go out there and figure that bite out, figure that them fish out under these conditions, under these different conditions from week to week or month to month or tournament to tournament, that's essentially what it takes to do it. And you guys did it. And
one thing that was so different from our bite compared to a lot of the people we talked to was we caught the majority of our fish early.
Early in the year, early in the morning?
Early in the morning. There's a lot of times we had our bag by 10:30 and we go for the big bite. And one tournament in particular, we did not catch another keeper after 10:30. It was a grind.
Yeah.
And you know, we just kept our head down. That's why it's important to have a partner that you fish well with, because you can run out of things to talk about. And when things continually go good on the bad days, when the bad days are good because of the partner that's in the boat, that's where, in a team series, that I think guys can excel.
I was just thinking about something when you were talking about fishing with guys, and I almost brought up something about maybe running down the lake and getting hit with a bat.
No. Yeah.
I don't think you guys have ever heard that story. Josh probably heard it. Did I ever tell you that story, Bill? Oh, can't hear. But anyway, it's maybe for next segment we'll talk about it. That was a good story.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, you guys really do men well together. You fish well together, and you're able to agree on what to do that was the right decisions. Because so often I tournament fish too, you know, so I know what it's like to have a partner that you don't always necessarily see eye to eye in, or you're wanting to do something, they're wanting to do something else, and if it don't work out, it's that person's fault, and you don't really, you know, it's a team thing. So you just we do this as a team. We win as a team. We lose as a team. You know, that's the way it goes. And you guys done a good job figuring them out. And was there any particular baits? I know you guys said you were catching on brush, and you know, what kind of? I mean, what makes you think? What do you think kept you more consistent at catching these fish? I know you said you caught them early. Do you think that was the key to it? It was hitting these certain spots early? Or do you think it was just because you guys were swinging for the fence late because you already had a limit?
I honestly think it was staying committed. We knew where fish was. We just had to figure out how to catch them. And there was several times we would be there and we would go without a fish for 2 hours. Not even a short, just nothing. And you start second guessing. And then you know what some other guys were going to do, so you're like, well, maybe we should be doing that. And that's a tournament fisherman's worst nightmare, is to start second-guessing what you're doing. Because when that happens, you end up with 20 rods on the box, and Josh knows as well. There was a tournament, I mean, I had 9 rods with something different on every one of them, and I threw everything that day, but I never committed to one bait. And Josh caught all 5 keepers that day. I boated a fish 2:30 in the afternoon, and it was a short.
Sometimes the net man is just as valuable as the guy on the end of the line that's got the fish too, you know.
Yeah.
There's so many times that's why it's a team, you know, and it could go either way. And You know, that's why we're a team. When you're when you got a team partnership like that, you know, netting the fish can sometimes be, like I said, just as valuable as the guy that actually hooked it and caught it. But that's good. And staying consistent and, you know, being resilient, not giving up. That's the biggest thing. How many people just say, well, you know what? I haven't got a bite in 2 hours or 3 hours. And it's so hard, especially the conditions. I know some of them tournaments, you guys had some terrible conditions. I mean, brutally cold outside, rain, sleet, freezing rain, just miserable. That takes a pretty diehard fisherman to go out there and do that just for the competitive edge of it. I do it to, you know, sometimes to make money or not to, but, you know, we all do it. We love to fish, and that's the passion that comes out in all of us. So what do you think, Josh, on what were you thinking? Did you ever think you guys truly had a chance? I mean, obviously, everyone thinks they got a chance. Otherwise, they wouldn't be competing. But when did it really register you guys like, hey, you know, this is pretty cool. We could win this again, you know, after you won the spring of 2013?
Well, you know, we didn't – neither one of us got to pre-fish like we would have liked to. So a lot of the tournaments, we were just flying by the seat of our pants and hoping for the best. But I think each tournament we just went out and just to have fun. And we made the decision that we were just going to go and go fishing.
Yeah.
And like I said, we got fortunate them spots held out. And the baits changed a couple of times on us. But, I mean, we pretty much just threw we threw a lot of things just about every tournament. And whatever the fish would eat, that's kind of what we'd stick to. But the last tournament was a 360 degrees from what we had been doing. We didn't have a fish early in the last one, and we had to leave our, of course, you know, them fish move around a lot, so they eventually left, which we figured they would. We feared that they'd eventually leave, and just really I don't think either one of us imagined that we were going to win that last tournament.
Oh, I know. That's pretty special right there to end it off with the way you did it. And, you know, hey, I want to talk about that in our next segment. Let's talk about some of the key baits you guys used as far as, you know, what really was your – the key baits that really got you to where you was. And we'll talk about how it turned flip-flop from the tournaments to the last tournament. But we'll be back coming up in segment two, back with Justin Travis and Josh Cornelison. I'm Tommy Benson. This is Wild at Heart. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM. This segment is brought to you by Cowtown USA, home of Can-Am ATVs and UTVs, located in Cuba, Missouri. We're back with Justin Travis and Josh Cornelison talking about their USA Bassin Championship this fall. And welcome back, guys. Well, this is what we're going to talk about. We was talking about the different baits you guys had and that got you to the championship, or not necessarily the championship, but to put you in a position to win, you know, to ultimately win the points championship. And I'm sure it was probably a shock for a guy like Jim Young, that was a three-time back-to-back-to-back, I guess, three-time in a row. You said he won it 3 years in a row leading up to this year. So I'm sure that was kind of a shock for him, and I don't know how well some people may not take it as well as others, but either way, yeah. I'm glad to see you guys win it, and congratulations to you both. And so what are some of the key baits? You know, you don't have to be down to the size and color and you know, gauge a hook or anything like that. But, you know, and just essential. Would you guys catch them on? Was you cranking with spinner baits? I mean, what was it? What's some of the things you can really say really helped catch some of your fish?
I'd have to say the shaky head.
Shaky head. Yeah.
That was the bread and butter. And the fourth tournament, neither of us thought about throwing a shaky head at all.
And the fourth tournament, was that the last one?
No, that was the next to last.
How many tournaments are there in that series? There's five tournaments total in the series. Okay. So tournament number four, which is – they're all big, because if you blow it, if you bomb in any one of these tournaments to come up there with like two fish for like 4 pounds or five, you know what I mean? You're out of it.
Yeah, and see, tournament four, Jim Young won. So he closed the gap on us because we took over first place in the third tournament. And so it was ours to lose, but he was right there. And then he won the fourth one. We took second. And then we took first in the fifth. And I think he took third or fourth. So, I mean, he was right there.
Yeah.
And
the fourth tournament, the water temperature had dropped. And I almost didn't even tie that shaky head on because I think in the third tournament, the shaky head bite wasn't there for us. We still fished the same spots, but we just caught them on jigs. And actually, a homemade jig that I'd tied up the night before is what the fish were eating.
I think I've got one of your homemade jigs that I stole from Justin over the summer. I showed it to Justin. I said, Omega's got one that looks almost identical. I love this color. But anyway, that's cool. So you probably that's probably about all you use nowadays is the ones you tie up, isn't it, Josh?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I try not to buy any jigs.
Yeah, I'm the same way. It's fun to tie your own, and you can make colors that nobody else produces, or you know, make whatever you want, how you want it.
But that's a good story on the what he was leading up to was we'd been forcing the jig, trying to get him to bite, and it's funny how anytime you catch a big fish or your partner does, there's always something that was said before it, at least with me and Josh, because there's one thing I can guarantee you, me and Josh have in a boat over anyone else any given day is
monster.
No.
Copy.
We have more fun than I guarantee you than anyone else on that water when we're fishing, on the good days and the bad days. But he was like, well, he goes, I guess I'm going to try this shaky head. And first,
like it was the last resort. Pitch. Like, I don't know what else to do.
We didn't have a fish in the boat. And we literally was kind of wondering what we were going to do. And first pitch in, he hooks one. And we're in a pretty tight spot. It's not a – wasn't ideal for trying to get the fish and get it netted and everything. And we net it, and it ended up being a 556. And that was our first fish of the tournament.
Wow.
That morning.
And this was tournament four?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we abandoned the jig, and we ended up taking second place that day. And it was just a shaky head thing. I mean, we stuck to it, and we both looked at each other at the end of it and said, boy, if you'd ever told me we'd have threw shaky heads today. You know, and caught them.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, I wouldn't have thought that.
The shaky head is we were fishing a magnum worm on it, a big worm.
Yeah.
So the water temperature dropped a lot. It was getting cold. Wouldn't have dreamed that they would eat that big worm.
Yeah, you're thinking, okay, size down, finesse tactics, something lot, you know, nothing big like that. But that's definitely kind of a shocker. But you know, That's what, you know, makes or breaks the season right there, is making the right decisions and being able to capitalize on them once you figure something out. Just like you guys were talking, your bite from the first four tournaments. Or no, Josh was saying you guys have been catching all your fish early in the morning. And then the championship, when it's all on the line, you guys knew you controlled your own destiny. All we got to do is win this tournament, and we can't lose. So I'm sure – Go ahead, Jerry.
Okay, yeah, let me interrupt here. Explain to we fly fishermen what a shaky head is.
Well, a shaky head, Josh, go ahead and explain them what a shaky head is, and then.
Well, it's a stand-up jig head, no skirt, and there's a lot of different styles of shaky head.
A lot of different ones.
But different sizes, weights, shape of the head.
But, shank of the hook, short shank, long shank, you know, there's just different.
Much like articulated streamers, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
But what it does, it stands up on the bottom.
So instead of it just laying down, you know, you got that stand-up jig, like Josh said, and then you got this worm sticking straight up, you know, it's a killer combination, or the shaky head in general is a great bass.
And you can fish anything on them.
Anything.
I was just curious. I've heard a lot of different terms from you you bass fishermen, but that's a new one on me.
The shaky head?
Yeah.
Yeah? That's yeah. We haven't talked a whole lot about that one in the last couple of months. So that's how they won. You know, that was their main weapon of choice there for the USA Bassin Series this fall. And then again, like you said, the first four tournaments, you guys have just been I mean, you've been catching your limit by 10:30, and then so it's almost like, hey, you know, let's just fish for a big one. It's real easy to do that, and it seems like it never works out good for me that way. I always seem like I need to figure something out. You know, we've only got a couple fish, and it's just figure something out late in the day. But that's a good feeling. So now you're going into the last tournament, and now you guys haven't figured anything out early.
No, it's 15 degrees. Live wells are froze shut.
Oh, that's something else.
Our fishing poles look like a barbed wire fence in an ice storm. By the time we run to where we were running, I mean, it was just brutal.
Couldn't even get the rod box open or the live wells open. Everything's froze shut.
Absolutely brutal.
Your eyelids are froze open.
Yep. And about 3 hours into it, we had one really small one in our honey hole. And we just had to go fishing. I mean, we just said, let's go. We were literally driving around looking for what we thought might hold the fish. And it's something different. Me and Josh love to fish docks. That's no secret. Anyone that knows us, we love fishing docks. But we're just not go out and pound banks. That's just not the way we like to fish. But we were just driving around, and Josh caught one. Then he caught another one. It's kind of like, huh. So we started putting two and two together, and we were finding these little, maybe 10-foot long sections on a bank that might be 100 yards long that was holding the fish. And we literally just run and gunned all day, hopping back and forth, going to different places. And we put it together that way, which ended up being our biggest bag of the season, was 1657.
And if I remember right, because I've talked to you about this, if I remember right, Josh, you guys all had done a little bit of pre-fishing, tried to a little bit, but it just wasn't working out.
That was the only tournament we went up on Saturday, and it was really cold.
Terrible.
And I had my dad with me, and he's not a bass fisherman.
At all.
And I was just going to try to get on this Main Lake Point bite that all the dock talk's talking, Main Lake Points, Main Lake Points.
Yeah.
Well, I couldn't even sniff a bite. And my dad is just, you know, he's like,
crappie
well,
fisherman.
Yeah. He's like, I'm not doing this. So, and Josh was up there with his dad. So, and Josh and his dad put the time in. I mean, they bass fished all day.
Well, I just know, you know, what you told me about how you guys, especially Josh and his dad, put all that time in. I mean, fished and fished and fished, and it just was so tough. I mean, like brutally tough. Brutally tough. Then to go back the next day and go back to the same thing you couldn't, that didn't work the day before, that to me is impressive that you can at least have the confidence to say, we've got to try something. We got to do something.
Yeah, and that's the crazy thing, because I took my dad crappie fishing. We put together a pretty good mess, but the next day we ended up doing exactly what we did Saturday that didn't produce anything.
Yeah.
And ended up catching our biggest bag of the
season. Ended up.
But that's where the commitment thing comes in. You have to be committed. It doesn't matter if we're smallmouth fishing on the river. You develop a pattern, and you have to commit to it. If you're not committed, you're going to be like I was in the one tournament where you're just throwing everything, but you're not really fishing anything. You're just winging it out there hoping to get a bite instead of actually fishing it. And
you know, there's a lot of, like you said, just almost like what you're saying, a lot of people just kind of go through the motions. They're just throwing it out there and just not even really paying attention to all the little subtle details that may or may not be going on. You know, a real light bite or whatever it is, or something just, well, hey, you know, we got a little bit of wind. Maybe we need to think about that. It may be different than the day before, or the water temp or whatever it is. So that is it.
How about trying to locate where they're holding in the water column, too? Is that one of the things you do?
Yeah, I don't know. Josh will back me up on this. About the only thing we use a graph for is water temperature and the depth. I mean.
Yeah, we had to have the right depth under the boat. And once we figured out where the fish were, it was game on. It was probably the funnest tournament we'd had all season.
Yeah, that's what Justin said.
I've never been that dialed in where it was pull up. And honestly, to your question, Jerry, the way we figured out where they're at in the water column was by how hard the crankbait was hitting off the rocks. You couldn't have a fast where it was just bang, 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 bang. It had to be more of a skipping action. About every second half, it would hit something. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you came off to where you wasn't hitting anything, they were there. But, I mean, it was a small enough section. And we fished probably, what, Josh, 8 or 10 different banks. And
yeah,
it was a small enough section that if you wasn't, Josh was throwing ahead, and I was trying to throw about 3 foot behind his line, so we were covering alternating paths back to the boat, so we weren't skipping a lot of water. And you would miss it pretty easy by just cruising down a bank fishing, and you'd miss that little spot that they were holding.
Well, the one thing for sure is you guys figured something out that no one else could. You kept it going through the whole season, and in the end, you guys are USA Bassin champions. And congratulations to you both, and thanks for both of you for being on the show. It's been a pleasure having you both on. And we always blow by when we get into a conversation like this, and that's the end of our segment here. So we've got to go on and go to segment 3. You're listening to Wild at Heart, and I'm Tommy Bench. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart. Remember, you can always listen to Wild at Heart anytime you want at our website at ESPN1073.com. Just click on Programming and Wild at Heart. Or if you have an Amazon Echo, just ask Alexa to play Wild at Heart from TuneIn Radio, and she'll bring up the latest episode for you. On this episode, we're talking about the current alternative method going on in the Missouri deer season, and what you can and cannot use, as we were just discussing, for the alternative method. So what are some things, Bill, that you know of? We were just talking about it a second ago off air, but What are your favorite alternative methods that you prefer?
Wow. Of course, I go way back, you know. We were using rocks and sticks back in my day.
Slingshots, homemade slingshots. <Yeah. laughs>
It is such a cool season because all the people that use the, quote, weird weapons, I guess, you know. Uh-huh. Muzzle loaders are probably the most popular weapon used in the alternative method season, and there's lots of them out there. You get the guys, you know, that like to use the really old stuff, the flintlocks. Well, that's
with
cool.
All the smoke and
yeah. You shoot one of those things off, then you got to wait for a minute and a half for smoke to clear.
Well, did it run off? I don't know.
What direction did it go? Yeah, for sure. But they are fun, and of course, the inlines are legal too during that season. But Tommy, I got to tell you, one of the most fun weapons I've ever used in the alternative, and it used to be a doe season, you know, in January, but is a handgun.
Yeah. Handgun, now,
one of my favorites.
Yeah. Now, there's a challenge, Jerry, because we all know that handguns, unless you're really a good shot and practice a lot, you're not going to shoot a terribly long distance with a handgun.
You could probably shoot further with a bow and arrow than you could with a pistol.
Almost accurately. Yeah.
Accurately, right.
Now, of course, you can use a scope on those handguns, and that's what I do. Open sights,
that
I wouldn't
helps.
Stand a chance. I couldn't hit that wall 10 feet away, probably with the open sights.
The longest shot I prefer to take with a handgun, and that's with open sights, by the way, is about 25 yards.
Yeah, and really, honestly, unless you practice quite a bit, that's difficult. And I learned that lesson in the military, shooting a .45. I was actually in the first class of officers that were required to qualify with a .45. They always just passed them out. Remember those days?
Oh, yeah, but those things were as loose as a goose, you know.
I know. I tell you, I hadn't been around pistols much. I grew up with shotguns, but I was the first one in the line in this stall I was in, and they just told us, walk up and shoot it, put a clip in and shoot it. No instruction whatsoever. I picked this thing up with one hand, pulled the trigger, and it almost hit me between the eyes.
Oh, I bet it did.
But I figured out real quick, like, it was going to rise and go to the right, shooting a 25-meter target. So I literally aimed at the lower left corner of this
compensated
target. Yeah, it come up right in the chest, you know. So that was easy enough. And I qualified in the first round. One of four out of a company of 250 guys that qualified the first round. So I thought I was an expert pistol shot, but learned quickly that I was not.
First deer you shot at, you realized you wasn't, didn't you?
I missed.
I bet a lot of people did.
And, well, and that was with a scope. I couldn't figure out what had happened. And I just knew, I blamed it on the scope. I had to have bumped it off. I actually got out of the stand, walked out in the woods, and picked out a sapling about 30 yards away, and shot it again, and dead centered it. So I missed the big deer, but hit a little bit of sapling.
It was just, a mistake.
About 20 minutes later, 15 more deer came by. This was up in North Missouri and killed my first one, big doe with a 44 mag. And about a foot of snow on, boy, the blood trail was easy to follow.
Wasn't hard to track, was it?
No, no. I was so proud of myself, and I've killed several more since then. But
I've shot with a Model 29 Smith 44 mag, and with some of my hand loads, one of the biggest mistakes I ever made, I thought I was going to be real smart and load down a Speer 225 grain half jacket at hollow point. Well, guess what happens to that bullet when it hits a bone?
Yeah, those things do happen, Jerry.
Yep, they do.
So how long has these pistols been allowed in the alternative method? Do you know?
That I'm not sure. I think almost from the beginning. Well, the first one I killed, that's in the 1980s, I want to say.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, so this has been that long. Well, what did they add? I thought this was fairly new, or maybe it was the calibers added.
Now, see, what I'm referring to is the old, they called it a doe season.
Mm-hmm.
It was always in January. Now, this alternative season is fairly new. I want to say within a decade.
Probably so. I shot my first deer with a handgun back in the 70s, the early 70s.
Well, that was probably regular deer season.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, it was regular firearm season then.
Well, and I'm missing something because I've been hunting my whole life. I know I haven't been around as long as you two have, but I remember this whole new ordeal about the alternative season, you know, and a pistol, saying now you can hunt with a pistol. We've never – it used to be – well, I thought it was always black powder season. And then they changed it from black powder to alternative, which you guys just informed me.
You're correct. And I'm not sure when they added the pistol into those seasons, but you could always use a pistol in
during
modern firearms.
Okay.
Yeah. Certain caliber, as long as it was –
It had to be a revolver.
Right.
Oh, it had to be a revolver. It had to be a revolver. No semi-automatics whatsoever.
No. It was a revolver.
Well, it's kind of like now, even if you're hunting with a rifle, you can't have more than, five bullets?
Think it's five rounds.
Five rounds in your you can't have a chamber. So if you have a magazine more than five, it's not allowed.
It's taboo.
Yep.
Bad for sure. Deal. But no, the pistol thing has been around for quite some time, and there's been a kind of a resurgence in interest in the sidearms, and it really is just a cool deal, ton of fun. I might even try it this year again. I used a Smith & Wesson for years, and then I banged up my right arm, had some serious nerve damage, and the doctors highly suggested I get rid of the big calibers, the 44s, the 30-06s, and I got rid of all those guns. Then I got better. Didn't anticipate that, so
yeah.
I had to replace them all, of course. Mm. And now I'm shooting a Taurus 44, which does a pretty good job.
Yeah, Taurus 44.
And they're built on old Smith & Wesson machinery, you know, that was sold to them years ago.
Look a lot like them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really do.
I was telling you, I got an old 7-shooter, which I never knew 7-shooters existed. So I got this gun. I've had this gun for 10 or 12 years.
Well, you'd have done well in the cowboy days.
Oh, yeah, because they'd have thought, he's done. Got one more. But it's a 1914 Nagant. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Have you ever heard of that? 7-shooter revolver.
Yeah, that.
It's a Russian. It's a Russian gun.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That explains. They always cheat.
Yeah. But that's what it was. It was a I looked it up, and it was used for, back in those days, a lot of assassinations, you know, basically right to the back of the head as they're kneeled down, which I didn't do it, so it doesn't bother me.
What's the caliber, if I may ask?
If I remember, I think it's a 6-point. Boy, you know, you would ask. And I get confused because I've got a 6.8 millimeter AR, which is now they're coming out with that in the military, and that's supposed to be the biggest, baddest, newest, long range AR that are coming out. I'm pretty sure I thought it was 6.8, though. 6-point-something millimeter is what it is. 6-point. I'll have to look it up. But it's a pretty neat pistol.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got the date stamped right on the side of it. You know, in the cast, you can tell what year it was made, in 1914. So that was pretty neat that I've got a gun over 100 years old. So
Wow.
So, yeah.
That is cool.
I'll have to show it to you guys sometime.
Love to see it sometime. I'm always interested in looking at guns, particularly those that I'm not familiar with and have not seen before. Yep.
And some of that old stuff is really cool. You know, they were well made.
Jerry knows.
Some of the old five-screw Smiths and so on, they just don't make them like that anymore. Yeah.
So, hey, Bill, we were talking, Jerry, both, we were talking about the different methods in the alternative season. So let's talk about, let's just mention a few methods that people out there have the option to use. We was talking about the atlatl. I mean, that's probably not my first choice, but it's something unique that someone could try.
I might have tried that in my younger days, but that's just become legal in, what, the last 2 or 3 years?
Yeah.
Just recent.
It's been longer than 2 or 3 years.
May have been, but
you know how
only one or two people in the state of Missouri
harvested a deer with one.
With an atlatl.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how much practice that takes?
Takes some skill. That takes some skill.
It's for the younger guys,
Jerry. Yeah. Air rifle. You was talking about air rifles.
That is really a cool
deal. 40 caliber or larger air rifles.
40 caliber or larger air rifles. Yeah. Who'd ever thought that? You can deer hunt with an air rifle in the alternative season.
I know, but they do the job. These newer ones are powerful weapons.
Nothing like the old Red Riders when we were.
I tell you what, I may still
shoot
have
your
some,
eye out.
I still have some whelps from Red Riders. I mean, it's not a laughing matter, but I went to a high school buddy's funeral a couple years ago, and he still had a BB in his chin from some BB gunfights that we had when we were kids.
Really?
Yeah, we never shot any eyes out. I'm surprised.
Well, yeah, me too. Because we
some
shot
BBs
each other.
Dug out of some behinds, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I guarantee it. I got
been
shot
there,
in
done
the
that.
Stomach.
Yeah.
I got shot in the stomach once with a pellet gun. You know, the old pump up pellet gun, point blank.
Oh.
It was empty.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
it was the ones that always get you.
Yeah. It was a bad deal, but. You know, I survived it.
Well, I can't imagine, you know, things going on today that we did as kids. It was always great fun to get in somebody's big barn full of hay and throw rotten tomatoes, potatoes, and eggs and shoot each other with BB guns, you know.
We'd be in jail today for doing that kind of stuff.
And we all survived.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're not trying to condone that it's okay to shoot each other.
No. We'll have parents after us like crazy.
Oh, yeah. We'll have
kids, do not shoot each other with BB guns or any other gun.
Please read disclaimer. Any kind of projectile.
Yeah.
So
they will hurt you.
They will hurt. Do not aim a gun at anybody.
Yeah.
Unless you plan on shooting them. That's not on us. So
you just run their disclaimer.
I know. I'm terrible.
But this alternative weapon season, it's a great addition. It gives you the opportunity to spend a little more time in the woods. And, you know, if you're like me, if you do hunt like I do, I'm still eating baloney.
Well, hey, let's continue this conversation here in a little bit. I've got a good deer story to talk about.
Oh,
Maybe you do.
Yeah.
So stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Tommy Benson. You're listening to Wild at Heart.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart, your source for information about what's going on in the world of outdoor recreation in the Ozarks and points beyond. This segment of our show is brought to you by the Missouri Trappers Association, dedicated to preserving the heritage and skills of trapping. We're back here talking about the alternative season going on right now and the different ways and weapons you can choose to do this alternative season. So Bill was talking about his pistols experience in the past and getting better at it. And the first deer he ever shot at, he missed. And I've never really had a lot of experience in the alternative method. I'm just simple. I'm either shooting a bow and string. I shoot a compound bow, and I love doing it. Or I'm shooting my rifle during the firearms portion. But I have also archery hunted a lot, as we were just talking about, during the firearm season, just because I hunt really thick timber anyway, and so I'm always close quarters. Even the deer I've shot with my rifle over the years, they've all been less than 40 yards. So anyway, it's just fun to know that you done, because there's a lot of movement involved in archery. But so anyway, what are some of the things we're talking about? Pistols and air rifles, 40 caliber above, an atlatl. What are some other things we were talking about, or that there is options of? Because there's some crazy things that well, like the air rifle.
Well, crossbows. Crossbows is exactly. One of them. Yeah. Yep.
Do you know that crossbows now are legal to hunt during the archery season, though?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Yes. But that's new. That's within the last couple of years.
Yeah, that was a long battle here in the state of Missouri. And praise to our Missouri Department of Conservation, they are slower than most states to make changes in regulations. They really research things out. And, of course, a lot of your bow hunters got upset when crossbows were legalized. And I used to be against crossbows as well until I injured an arm and got older. But, you know, your average bow hunter drops out at age 49 because of wrist, elbow, shoulder problems.
Yeah.
And the crossbows have helped. I'm almost 70 years old. Crossbows brought a lot of the older hunters back in. And also, we've seen a lot of growth and interest among women and girls coming into archery because of the crossbows. But everybody had this discussion, I don't want to say argument, but had this discussion online again just this week. Some guys were fussing and fighting about it was a compound hunter and a crossbow hunter, you know. But I have written several articles over the years about crossbows and did all the research. Some states around Georgia, Kentucky, Ohio have had crossbow seasons for over 30 years, and they've got the statistics. Everybody said, you know, crossbows are going to wipe out the deer population. Sorry, folks. The statistics from those states have been in business with crossbows during the archery season for over three decades.
And there's still regulations. You can't just go out there and shoot unlimited amount of deer.
Exactly. But the facts are the percentage of kills between compounds and crossbows is exactly the same, 15%.
Really?
Yeah. Now, initially, crossbows were permitted for handicapped people.
Exactly.
As
had to have a medical exemption.
And that's not the case anymore.
No.
You know,
no.
And like you said, Bill, it's drawn so many other people that probably would never have been younger children that can't pull back bows, you know, strong enough to shoot,
exactly.
Or women, or older people that have had a rough, not necessarily a rough life, but like you said, at 49 years old,
that's the average dropping out.
That's true. I mean,
that's pretty young.
When you're talking about draw, that's very young. When you're talking about drawing a bow back, you know, 60, 70 pounds, 50, it's still a lot, and there's a lot of movement involved, and there's an expense in it, and there's just, I have not got a crossbow yet, but here I'm 39 years old.
Boy, it's catching up with you.
Most of my buddies have already got one.
Well, yeah, when I was a young man, actually in my late teens, I had a Ben Pearson recurve bow, 70-pound pull bow. Could I pull that bow back today? I sincerely doubt it.
But another pro for the crossbow situation is simply the fact that we need the hunters.
Yeah,
some guys don't. Some guys don't want the competition out there, but you know, we're one of only two states in the whole nation that are holding our own with hunters and actually gaining a little bit. Everybody else is losing. In the last 30 years, we've lost 30% of our hunters in this country, and it's gotten so bad that a lot of the fish and game departments who don't have the 1/8% sales tax like we do. They're about to go out of business because they lost so much revenue from license sale. Now, that's serious. What's it going to be like in the next 50 years?
Well, it's going to become even more serious. And, I think that here in Missouri, you know, you hear people criticize our conservation department from time to time. But I tell you, I think we've got one of the finest in the country.
We got the best in the country.
Yeah, we do.
Hands down. No doubt about it. But in the discussion that was going on online this week, these guys are fussing and fighting. And I'm look, guys, we're all trying to do the same thing using a little bit different method. And we hurt ourselves so badly as hunters with all of this infighting.
I agree.
It's just not worth it. And my point was, what are you arguing about? It's legal. How can we argue about somebody's method if they're legal?
Exactly. And, you know, that happens a lot with all of us serious. You know, I'm a serious smallmouth fisherman. I know I'm getting completely. We're talking about conservation and and legalities as far as why. I can't argue with it. Someone keeps their smallmouth. I don't keep smallmouth. But I'm not going to say, you know, that's their right. They can keep that if they want. And it's legal. Our society's come to be a catch and release
society. Yeah, it really has. Really Bass fishing created that.
Yeah, it did.
It really did. And it's not a bad thing. It's been a good thing for sure.
I can't tell you when I last kept a fish. I can't remember.
I can tell you when I last kept one. <That's pretty nice. laughs> I like to eat those rascals. So don't eat smallmouth.
Nope. Crappie are good.
Oh, crappie.
Walleye.
Big bluegill. I'm getting
right.
Ready to,
big bluegill.
Write an article about that that Jerry's going to help me out with. But, no, great things happening in the outdoors. And we were talking about firearms deer season just a moment ago. You know, during the regular firearms deer season, just recently, there were almost 50 million people in this country out in the woods with firearms, and there was not one mass shooting.
Yeah, I know.
Amazing,
not
isn't
Not one. You know why, don't you? We all know why, because we have common sense.
Yeah. Well, all the other guys had weapons, too.
That's right. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. It is.
You let your country protect themselves, and there's no danger that happens to us, is there?
Exactly right. But, you know, there are a few injuries and a few deaths every year involved, but the most dangerous thing you can do every day is get in your automobile and leave the house.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But for 50 million people to be out in the woods with firearms and no mass murders.
None.
None of that.
None at all.
Yep.
No shootings. Yep. It's a, you know, it's a great state we live in and a great country we live in. And you know, it's, I'm glad we have the rights we do. You know, there's a lot of countries that don't have the, what we have here in our state or country in general.
Well, really, only a handful of countries have the freedoms,
exactly,
particularly with firearms, that we have in this country.
Yep.
And it's all joking aside, it's serious business to be armed as a country. Other research I did for an article just a few years ago, you know, if you took just the deer hunters from the four most popular deer hunting states in the nation, you'd have the largest military in the world.
Exactly. And you know, hunting and fishing both in some countries such as the United Kingdom is strictly a rich man's sport.
Yep. Exactly. And boy, that's such a shame, you know. And we all, I think, at times take for granted what we have in this country, and we get to griping and complaining, you know, until a buddy shakes us a little bit and says, hey, why don't you go here? Why don't you go there?
And see
what it's like.
Exactly.
And again, we're extra spoiled in the state of Missouri because of the natural resources that we have. I mean, man, we've got, you know, look at the Boot Hill. Look at North Missouri, Western Missouri. And, of course, my favorite, the Ozarks, Tommy.
The Ozarks.
With those smallmouth.
I love the Ozarks.
I mean, you know, how many rivers can you get to within an hour?
Oh, I tell you what, time. Bill, you know, I'm a native Kentuckian. And
that's too bad.
I know.
That is too bad.
Outside of basketball, I'm proud to say I'm a resident of Missouri.
Well, you got the Bourbon Trail over there, too, I think.
right. But, yeah, this is absolutely some of the most beautiful country you will find in this country. And the resources that we have here as far as fish and wildlife is just unbelievable.
Yeah, too. And the thing I love about it just excites me. But, you know, just south of us here, we've got the largest block of wild lands between the Appalachians and the Rockies.
Exactly.
Right here, full of rivers and streams and public lands. Look at Shannon County, better than 90% public property, you know. We can go just south of Rolla and get on the U.S. Forest Service lands.
Yeah. And you know, I was talking to a buddy of mine today about that. Or just the other day, today or yesterday, I can't remember what it was, but about all the different streams and rivers we have around here, and they're so much different. The scenery is different. They're all beautiful in their own way. You know, some of them have majestic bluffs. Some of them have just the most beautiful wildlife and trees and fields. You know, I know it's hard to think that a field can be beautiful, but I would just see
they are.
Oh, they are.
Absolutely.
You know, bluffs.
Wildflowers.
Yeah, absolutely.
We even have rainforests here. Don't we have a type of rainforest there at Pickle Creek or Pond?
Yeah, well, there's some very unusual things, particularly in the Ozarks, because, you know, this area over the last 10,000 years or so has been covered by shallow oceans five, six, seven times. And we're called a melting pot here because we get, you know, plants and animals both from all four directions. You know, for instance, pawpaw trees subtropical plant. We got the northern pitcher plant that come from way up north. We've got a few poplar trees in State Park down towards the Boot Hill, just above Cape Girardeau. There's a small pocket of poplar trees there, that tulip poplars, that only place they're found, wild, in the state of Missouri. And they came from across the Mississippi. You know, you'll find them in Kentucky and Tennessee.
There's a lot
like
of things that we have that we didn't have when we were kids. Armadillos, for one thing. I mean, that's a fact.
That's one thing we could do without.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd rather them not be here. We never heard of mountain lions, you know, or, you know, not like we are now.
Exactly.
Bears. Same way.
Same deal.
Hey, we've even got a few roadrunners. I've seen
That's right.
A couple of them. So, yeah, Missouri's a great state. It's hard to beat.
Diane can attest to the bear around here, I think. Yeah.
Yeah,
she's got a bear story.
Well, let's listen to it. I want to hear this bear story.
We were camped on the 11 point.
Well, how about we listen to it right after this break?
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah.
Okay, folks, we'll be right back with Diane Cooper. And stay around. This is Wild at Heart.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart. We're happy to have Diane Cooper in the studio with us tonight, as well as her husband, Bill. And we're going to be talking to her a little bit more about her bear story before we start discussing her secrets of outdoor photography.
Thank you, Jerry. Yeah, first time I've ever been introduced before my husband, but usually I'm introduced as Bill Cooper's wife.
Well, you're a talented person in your own right, though.
Well, thank you.
Let's finish hearing about this bear story.
Well, a few years ago, Bill and I had gone down on the 11 Point River deer hunting, and we had fished for trout that day, and sun had set, and Bill cooked up the trout on the campfire, and we're sitting there eating. And
he's a good cook, isn't he?
He is a good cook, especially outside. He adds just a little bit of the gravel bar sand to make, you know.
Oh, it's fantastic.
That makes it nice and gritty, huh?
Makes it nice and gritty.
I've had it.
So we're sitting around the fire enjoying our fish and our dinner, and I hear something down at the river. We were camped up the bank a little bit, so I go down to the boat and grab the spotlight just to see what's going on, and I shine it across the river, and there's this big bear on the other side of the river. He's like, I smell fish. I'm coming. And I holler at him, there's a bear. And he comes down, no, there is. And I was like, yeah, there is. It's right there. And it starts headed up the hill, and I tell him to start the boat motor because something's got to scare this bear away. So he starts the motor and revs it a little bit and shuts it off, and I hear this bear just you hear him beating through the bush. This is the first night of a one-week trip.
Were you? So was your camping already set up? Your tent?
Camp was set up.
Oh,
everything.
No, Bill, did you have any kind of protective?
Pistol
or anything on you?
That was deer season.
Deer season.
So
yeah
we had high-powered rifles.
I had my 40 caliber.
All kinds of rocks and sticks. And
I mean, you know, yeah, something. But, I mean, obviously, you're not going to shoot a bear unless it's life-threatening. But.
Oh yeah, but it made for an exciting week. I have to add to this story now. Every night, well, even that night, like 2:30 in the morning, Diane woke me up. Bill, get your gun. The bear's coming across the river, you know. And I set up. Sure enough, you hear all this splashing. I mean, it sounded like a big animal coming across the river. So I grabbed a little pistol and a flashlight and in my underwear, ran outside to the river and grabbed the spotlight. It was three otters playing in the river.
Yeah. Three otters.
Three otters. So we had her scare. I don't think Diane slept all week, but the next night it was raccoons. And got down to that Thursday night, and man, my eyelids are swelled from lack of sleep, you know. And she woke me up, Bill, that bear's right outside the tent, you know. But it was a real dry fall, and we were camped under some sycamore trees with great big leaves, you know, really dry. And, boy, you could hear something walking in those leaves. And it sounded like an elephant, you know. I was convinced that bear was right there. So I'm peeking out of the tent with my little 22 pistol, my flashlight, and I can hear this thing, but I can't spot it. So I lean out a little further, and this white-footed deer mouse runs across the leaves. He sounded like an elephant. And a little guy picks up a breadcrumb, sits up, he's eating it, and I've reached and got the camera and zoomed in and took a picture of it and showed it to Diane. I said, here's your bear. He weighs about an ounce and a half.
Now, Diane, let me ask you, did you get an outdoor photograph of Bill in his underwear chasing after that bear?
Nobody wants to see that, really. I'll tell you what, that was one of the worst. I enjoy camping. I love the outdoors, but that was probably one of the hardest trips I ever had because I'd never had that experience close up with the bear. He sounded angry when he was going up the mountain, so I just knew he was coming to get us. So I finally talked myself into getting to sleep that evening, and I'm just falling off, you know, that part where you're almost there.
Yep.
I come up out of that bed, sat there on the edge of my cot with my rifle just staring at the tent door for the rest of the night listening to him snore. Because I didn't know if the bear was thinking it was a mating call. Or what.
Yeah, I know.
So that was a pretty...
What a fun trip. But, hey, Friday morning we get up. We're supposed to stay through the weekend, you know. It's drizzling rain. We're just miserable. We agreed. Let's pack up and go home. So we packed everything up and went home, and I'm unpacking everything, and what does she do?
I took a shower, got some fresh camo out of the dirt bag, went up to the food plot, sat there for about 20 minutes, and got my deer.
After all that.
Didn't get a deer the whole time. About 20 minutes, I sat in the blind, and
wow.
Bunch of deer come out.
So you was on the river
for a week.
Yeah, fighting bears.
A week, yeah. Fighting bears and
and deer mice and yeah.
But, oh, well, Diane, I wanted you in the studio this evening to talk to us about your outdoor photography with Christmas on us here and people getting new cameras for Christmas. And so I thought that it would be an interesting topic to discuss.
Well, yeah. You know, photography is one of my passions. I just love it. It's a great stress relief. And aside from capturing memories and the old adage, a picture's worth a thousand words.
Exactly.
And with hunters, they've get these beautiful deer or great fish mm-hmm. when they're fishing. And they take these pictures with the deer in the back of a pickup truck, and the pickup truck's got the beer cans and the trash bags,
yeah.
or they've got the deer hanging from their
rafters.
And
all you
whatever.
See is a hay and four-wheeler in the back with a bunch of beer cans right. or whatever.
So when you get your new camera and you go out and you start taking photos, don't just look at what you're taking the photo of. Just like when you're hunting, be aware of what's beyond your target.
Right.
Look at your background. And you don't have to drag your deer out into the middle of the woods to get a good scenic photograph. Take it, like where we live, we have trees around the house. We could take it and get a beautiful picture right beside the truck without the truck in the photo.
Exactly.
You just need to look at your subject, and your subject does not have to be right in the center of your photo either. The law of thirds, separate mm-hmm. your view into thirds. Thirds up and down, thirds side to side, and place your subject towards one of the thirds so you've got a little bit more scenery. And then also stretching the arms out a little bit, make your fish look a little bigger.
Oh, Tommy knows that.
You know what's funny? I know all about that, but it's funny you're talking about your background. I am probably the master at noticing my background because I make sure nobody sees it so they don't know where I'm at.
Fish were notorious for
that's
that.
Good
yeah.
too. That's,
block
that's,
the background so somebody doesn't recognize it. Yeah. Go ahead.
Generic background.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Corey Cox was pretty good about that too, I think.
All you want to see is water, fish, and smile.
Yeah. Water, fish, and smile. Yeah. So nobody, no landmarks.
No landmarks.
Boy,
no
did laws. I ruin that exactly. for you on your last trip.
That's okay. Only for you, Bill.
Yeah. I'll never tell.
I know you won't.
What happens on the river stays on the river.
That's right.
Especially concerning big fish. But yep. I have to brag on Diane a little bit. She's really got the mechanical mind, and when it comes to fooling with cameras, you know, even the old cameras, she could shoot a few photographs and boy, look at a subject and tell you what speed she's going to use, f-stops and all that sort of thing. I almost had to write that stuff down. But she really came into her own a few years ago when she'd done enough work. She qualified for the Missouri Outdoor Communicators, which is a professional group of writers, photographers, TV, and radio people across the state of Missouri. And Diane got in, and they have an annual photo contest. Now, these people have been doing this for decades, and she won that thing the very first time she entered. I've entered it for 30 years and I've never won it.
Yeah, that's very impressive.
It is impressive. And to add insult to injury, she won it the next year as
You're
well.
You're kidding.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Congratulations.
About the first one, I didn't know about the second year.
Yeah.
2 years in a row.
But all my buddies really give me a bad time. I say, yeah, it's going to be a long ride home.
Yeah, yeah, oh, yeah.
But most of the time when you're looking at reading Bill's articles in the newspaper and you see where it says submitted photo, it really should say Diane Cooper photo.
Yeah, she don't get near the credit she should. I'm horrible about that. And I hear about it.
I'm here. Yeah. We went to Pennsylvania. I'm originally from Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh, and I wanted to go to Pittsburgh for quite a while, and he finally told me if I could find a smallmouth guide that was also a writer that would take him smallmouth fishing for free, we could go and I could see a Steelers game too. So
I think I've heard some of this.
It only took me about half an hour to arrange the whole trip.
You was on it, wasn't you?
I was on it.
I was thinking a year later.
So he didn't realize that I grew up out in Pennsylvania smallmouth fishing.
Yeah.
And we went up on the northern upper Allegheny, beautiful river, just gorgeous, and we're fishing for smallmouth. I taught them how to do it. You know, I caught the first fish, caught the most fish, caught the biggest fish, and caught the last fish. But I caught a really good-sized smallmouth, and we do generic pictures. You know, we hand the fish around, and everybody gets a picture with it.
Yeah.
Well, one of his rider friends needed a picture of a smallmouth. So he sends him a picture of him holding my smallmouth.
Oh, I remember now. Now I remember.
So he
I thought it was going to be funny.
He sets me up and so he can I tell him that's my fish, that's my picture. I ended up sending the guy an invoice for $250 for my photo that he put in Cabela's journal.
There you go. There you go.
Taught them both a lesson.
We weren't laughing anymore.
Yeah, dang it.
Hey, guys, we're about to wrap up this segment. But, boy, it's fun having my old buddy Bill Cooper in here and his talented wife, Diane, talking about her outdoor photography. And don't go away. We'll be right back with more from Diane Cooper. I'm Jerry Cook, and this is Wild at Heart.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM. This segment of our show is brought to you by Colton Steakhouse and Grill in Rolla, where we know what's at stake. I'm happy to have with us tonight Diane Cooper talking to us about her outdoor photography. Diane, welcome.
Thank you, Jerry. Glad to be here.
Well, as always, it's fun, you know, and how about a few more little tips there for people wanting to take some good outdoor outdoor photography?
Don't use somebody else's photo.
Yeah,
don't
right.
use somebody else's photo. That's a good one. Let's talk about lighting. I do a lot of landscape, and mm-hmm. I right now I'm working on
getting together a lot of photos for a coffee table book of Missouri barns, and I want to call it Missouri ruins, mm-hmm. you know, broke down barns, homes.
Interesting.
And that, and
I can help you with some locations and some good ones. There's a friend of mine, not trying to interrupt here, but he posted a picture of his farm barn. I mean, people love it. There's like 300 likes on this picture of this barn. He said, I didn't realize people love barns so much. They do.
Yeah,
they're very
important
popular.
Part of our history.
It is.
Old churches as well.
Old churches. Yep. I have some great photos of some old churches too. But people walk outside to take a photo when they see this bright sunny day and think, oh, this is a great day for photos. Actually, mm-hmm. that's one of the worst times to take photos. Overcast is probably your best time because your light is more muted. Mm-hmm. You don't have such stark contrast, dark shadows. Early morning, late evening, just before the sun goes down, that's great times to get your photos. I love to go out just before the rain or just after because the ozone, I call it, is just got that beautiful filter mm-hmm. to it, and it's great when you're shooting digital, because as we were talking off air,
right.
you can take 100 photos and you might only get one good one out of it, but you're not wasting anything. You're not wasting, but there's something to be said about film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, film just has that to it, but. Digital.
Back in my day, I used to shoot a 4x5 Linhof, and every time you tripped the trigger on that thing, it was about $2.50.
Yeah, and it's probably still more than that now.
I'm sure it is, yeah, because it's been quite a while. Yeah.
I got a question for you.
Sure.
Because I'm very ignorant on photography, and especially professional photography. I leave that up to you, the professionals. But I love taking pictures, and I'll see the moon that is just like, wow, that moon is beautiful. So I take my real nice iPhone 10 and think, well, it don't work. It turns out just to be a blurred ball. Looks like a light bulb. Might as well just be an old filament light bulb.
You know, the phones take great photos.
They do.
They do.
But not from light years away.
They're not made for distance. Now, they do have the lenses that you can buy for your phones. They're on little clips. You can put them on that do the telephoto.
Yeah.
They do have that. And that's really stealing away from the photographers that like the cameras.
Yeah.
But if you want to get that good picture of the moon, you're going to need a good long lens.
Is Canon make a pretty good camera?
Nikon? I'm partial to Nikon. Mm. I have a D500 Nikon that I
Well, it's
I
funny
really
you say
enjoy.
That because all my optics are Nikon.
Nikon.
Whether it be a spotting scope or my rifles, my digital camera.
Nikon is very, very dependable. They've got great optics. Mm-hmm. Their lenses are good. Canon, I've never used a Canon. I had a couple little point and shoots, but never a DSLR. There's other people that are partial to the Canon and won't shoot anything else. But
well, something I like to say about those, we talk about the phones, and I fuss at guys all the time, particularly you fishermen, packing these phones, and you catch that big, nice fish, and you take a photo with a phone. Boy, I just had an editor chewing my ears and other parts of my anatomy as well recently because I was doing an article and all I had was phone pictures somebody had sent me. You don't get the pixels with the phones.
Mm-hmm.
Most phones. Now, some of the newer ones are better, but you're just not going to get the quality of print photograph out of them. So I try to encourage guys to get you one of these little point-and-shoot
digital cameras.
Yeah. Because, buddy, that takes some awesome photographs, and it comes to getting something printed. If you're working with outdoor writers and you need to provide them a photograph, they'll be much better than the phone photos. So that's something to keep in mind. And they're not that expensive. And if you watch online and stuff, you can get your hands on used ones sometimes. Some of them take incredible photographs, man. And that's not knocking the phone. That's better than nothing. Believe me, and that's what most people are going to take. But you can get some of these little point-and-shoots that are waterproof as well.
Well, I got another question for you, Diane, or mm-hmm. both of you. Well, you know, which do you prefer between digital zoom or optical, and what's the difference? You know, what would explain to me that I don't know the difference between those two. So how would you explain the difference between those two?
The digital zoom, you've got so many pixels in your picture. The digital zoom lessens those pixels. The optical zoom, it actually magnifies because you've got your going lens.
Okay.
So the digital is basically, it's electronic zoom. So all you're right. just like on a computer screen whenever right. you zoom in on the picture, you're stretching it out. So you've got less pixels in that picture.
Well, a lot of times that'll make less pixels makes the quality a lot poorer, doesn't it?
Yes, it's going to become blurry. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
Right. So
absolutely.
I prefer the optical zoom. They're coming out with a new they've come out with a new mirrorless digital DSLR. I don't know how well I'm going to take to that. I prefer the mirrored because you can you get a better quality, I think.
Well, I take to it pretty well because not that I'm going with a mirror, but what's happening, the other cameras are dropping in price. I just bought a D7000 that was used to be close to $3,000 camera, just the body, and just pick one up for about $1,700.
Yeah, I've got I think it's a D3200 or 30. It's a 3000 series, and right. it's an awesome body. I'm like you, Diane. I've owned Nikon since back in the late 60s. The old manual,
mm-hmm.
you know, silver and black body Nikons, mm-hmm. 35 millimeter.
Yeah. But there's several brands out there that they all compete in a comparable, you know, whether it's Nikon, Minolta, whatever.
They're all good. Yeah.
They're all good. And then ever so often I hear somebody or see photographs and I think, boy, that's just incredible. And I look at the camera, never heard of the brand or something. You know? So there are lots of good optics out there, but I like to stick with that Nikon. You can't go wrong.
Yeah.
And you know, you were talking about the point and shoots earlier, to take those with you, and those you can get those cheap, and they take great pictures, and it's not something you have to worry about dropping off the boat or something. You're not going to mm-hmm. lose your $2,000-$3,000 equipment. So, and like he said, the phones take great photos, but they're not great print quality. So yeah, if you don't want to take an expensive, bulky, large DSLR, take a point and shoot. You don't have to worry about losing it.
And so when you say point and shoot, how would you reference a point and shoot to people that don't know what a point and shoot is? Literally just like going to Walmart or Best Buy or wherever you want, walking in there and getting a couple $100 digital camera.
Push a button and focuses. Yeah. And
you can get them for as cheap as $30, $40. They're about as big as a cell phone.
Yeah.
They're thin. They do. Most of those are digital zoom, though.
Well, because back in before the real nice phones come out, back in the mid-2000s, 05, 06, when flip phones were still popular, I had a Kodak digital camera, and that's what I used to take all my pictures. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, I catch the biggest smallmouth of my life. I didn't have no way to get a picture of it, so I ended up doing it. But anyway, that's what I was asking, because I have not had a digital camera in 12 years or so.
Right.
So I didn't know.
But when you buy the point and shoot, stay away from those that have a long zoom on them, because you're really going to lose the quality.
Right.
If you've got a nice fish, nice deer, you're going to be up close to take those photographs anyway. You don't need that big long zoom for that purpose.
But you mentioned them being waterproof, Diane. Bill, I know, knows him. My main fishing buddy, Mike, has a waterproof digital that he's taken some awesome pictures of fish that I have hooked underwater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's just, I was amazed the first time I saw him do this. I said, "What are you doing, Mike?" He's sticking this camera underwater, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And with the DSLR, you can actually get the waterproof cases mm-hmm. for those that, I mean, it just adds to the bulk. But for those of us that like to take the use our big camera.
Yeah.
I like that big camera up on my face. Mm-hmm. You can use the screen on the back. I don't like that. I'd like putting the but they have the waterproof cases that they'll go over your zoom lens and everything. So it's really the technology that's coming out these days.
Yeah. And I'm with you. I don't like the screen on the back. I prefer the old-fashioned viewfinder. Yeah.
Well, I'm a big GoPro fan. You can use them for the video. You can get them underwater.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely.
And they take pretty decent photographs. Yeah. You kind of get that fisheye look rounded on the edges, you know, so it makes for some cool photographs as well. I had mine out this week on the Merrimack doing a little fly fishing, caught a few nice fish. And the thing I love about that GoPro, man, I've got a handle on it that's got an alligator, huge alligator clip. I find me a flat rock.
That's it.
Stick it on there, leave it on the bank, turn it on, got a little short video, photographs too.
I use the same clip. It's amazing. You can use it almost anywhere. If you can find anything, the side of the boat, the side of the canoe, flat rock, a tree.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. One of the coolest little tools I own that goes with it, the guys from Ozark Traditions TV gave this to me. It's a magnet that'll stick to anything other than aluminum, I guess. Which is everything, you know. But I've used it. I've put it on my boat trailers, all kinds of cool things. And
for GoPro
mounts to that. Yeah, wow.
They come out with everything for GoPros nowadays. GoPros are pretty convenient. They're nice. We always run them in our tournaments and guide trips and whatnot. So, well, again, we just burned through another segment of Wild at Heart here. And, flew by, didn't it? Well, stay tuned. We'll be right back in a few minutes. You won't want to miss what's coming up next. This is Wild at Heart, and I'm Tommy Bench.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart, your source of information about the Ozarks and a few points beyond. This segment is brought to you by Gar Truck and Equipment and the Outdoor Superstore, your Husqvarna dealer located on the North Outer Road in St. James. We're back, and we still got Bill and Diane Cooper here with us, and we're going to be talking about the deer story that everyone's been wanting me to talk about. I've been really trying to put it in the back burner, and after every show, I hear you still didn't talk about the deer story.
You shouldn't have told it the first time.
I shouldn't have. And it's me and my dadgum social media addiction, I guess. I'm bad about putting everything on social media. I want everyone to stay in tune with what's going on with the show. And I left them hanging. I do that a lot. I'm real bad about just being real vague about something and just leaving it at that. And they're like, well, what is it? Or let's see. Or it didn't happen, you know. So I said, well, just stay tuned, and you'll hear it on the radio show.
Eventually.
Eventually. So here we are 3 weeks later after it happened. And here's how it happened. I'll finally tell the story. Okay, so my daughter was so pumped up about shooting her first deer. She's shooting my 6.8 millimeter AR. And she absolutely loved it. I mean, she said, "Dad, that is the coolest gun ever." And so I was like, okay, you know what? She's excited. She's 14 years old. She shoots this deer. She wants to go. She said, please take me next weekend. I said, next weekend's the adult version. You have your own weekend. It's youth season. Now it's adult season. And she said, Dad. And I was like, dang it. Okay. So I take her hunting. And then, anyway, long story short, I take her hunting, and then my daughter's mom was like, well, I've never been hunting before. Oh, great. Now I got two of them to want to go. This is my season. Again, this is my time. Anyway,
I thought.
So they made an agreement without me being involved. Oh, so this is the way it's going to work. They come to me. You're going to take mom this morning, and then you're going to take me in the evening. Oh, okay. I'm glad you guys planned that all out for me. So I take them hunting. Long story short, we're using this AR, okay? These are two inexperienced hunters, and the reason why I'm bringing that up is because it's got the adjustable stock, you know, for smaller people instead of them shooting my big 30-06 or the Woodstock 30-30, which doesn't kick that hard. But either way, she's used to this gun. She's comfortable with it. She shot it. So they both have a great weekend spent. So anyway, so now fast forward to my time. I think, finally, it's my turn. This is Sunday of the weekend, of opening weekend. They had their fun, got to shoot deer. Great. So I get out there that morning, Sunday morning, and I've got my AR still. Well, now we was in some open field, you know, hunting situation. Now I go back to where I told you is all close quarters, thick timber, and I've got that AR, and a couple does walk by, and I'm just wanting to put meat in the freezer, so I tag one, I shoot one, I load it, and do my duty, you know, I do what I'm supposed to do. Well, that evening, I think, well, I'm going to go back, and I started thinking, what am I doing with an AR in the middle of the woods? I can't shoot more than 40 or 50 yards. So I go to Old Faithful, I get my old Marlin 30-30 that I've had since I was 18 years old, 17, and I get out of the gun, unlock it, get it out, and I look, and there's shells in it. You know how a lever action gets loaded. So I'm thinking, okay, well, it's loaded. So, which is not, I'm not saying that's the right way to do it, but I knew that they had ammunition in it. So, and I go hunting, and I get up in my stand. I tie it off, pointing down. Of course, I don't. I try to be as safe as I can, you know. Anyway, I had it locked up in a case. Basically, it's in a carrying case. I lock it up, and that's how I travel with it. And then once I get there, I take it out. Blah, blah, blah. So I get up in the stand, and I'm sitting there. And this is that afternoon. Get it there about 3 o'clock. About 4 o'clock, I see legs walking through the woods, and so I start looking. And all of a sudden, I see it's a buck, and it's a nice one. I mean, it's a real good one, real good one. Like, one of the biggest ones that I've ever had walked in my woods. And I thought, well, I want to double check before I just get all excited because it's the first buck I've seen. This, you know, so I pull up my scope and I get a real good look at it. And then, yeah, there's a 4-point antler restriction. There's not even a question. There was no question. This deer did not even come close to that criteria. It was way above and beyond that. So I thought, yeah, I'm taking this deer. There's my opening, which is about 42, 43 yards away. I've got a gun, my 30-30. So it's walking, it don't know what's going on. And all of a sudden, I was getting ready to stop it or just shoot it as it was slowly walking because there was a good 15-yard wide gap. It just stops. Kind of checking the place out. I'm like, how perfect is this? This is absolutely perfect. I was already rested on the railing of my buddy stand, had the hammer pulled back, settled in. I mean, crosshairs on the vitals. So he's perfect. I mean, like 95% completely broadside. I squeeze the trigger. Click. Nothing.
That's a sick sound, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh. I didn't know. I thought, now this thing is 40 yards away. It's not like it's 150 yards away. So I'm slowly trying to get, and I know exactly what just happened. There was never a bullet in a chamber. I never chambered a bullet. I knew, it's almost like I knew there wasn't one chambered, but I didn't want to chamber one until I got up there, and I just completely forgot. I completely forgot to do it. Even when I seen the deer from 80 or 90 yards away, I had 20 seconds. That's a lot of time to chamber a bullet, or better, and I didn't. Well, this deer is right on the edge of being in some thicker timber, and so I start to try to chamber it, and it's slowly trying to pull that lever out. I'm going so slow, it's not wanting to go. And when it does, it does. Yeah. And it just sounds like you just threw a set of tambourines down or something, you know. And so this deer, it startles a deer. It did not flag or run. It just kind of hops a couple times into the woods and looks around, and I can just barely see its head. But its body was covered in tree limbs. There was no clear shot. And I've always talked about, I'm a very cautious hunter. And I thought, come on, back out. Just give me another chance. Please, Lord. You know, I never seen the deer again. He ended up just slowly walking off in the distance and he disappeared. So, you know, sometimes I still don't regret it because I'd rather be safe but that's it. I'd rather be safe than sorry, as they say, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And anybody that's hunted deer hunted any amount of time and had those sort of things happen.
You know what the worst part about this is? I've got almost the identical story that happened to me when I was 16 years old. When I was 16 years old, same gun, the same gun.
Why do you need to get a different gun?
And you called it Old Faithful.
Well, the reason why is because, well, that was about 15 or 16 years old. The first time it happened, same deal. I never chambered, but I had them pushed in there. I just never chambered one. Mm-hmm. Got settled in on this nice buck and just click. And I never got a chance at him. That was when I was 15 or 16. Now I'm turning 40, so 20 to 30.
Second time around.
25 years later, 24 years later. I mean, so I went 20 plus years of never having that happen again. That's why I call it Old Faithful. Now we're back to the drawing board. Now I got to start all over with faithfulness.
Tommy, let me ask you this. You mentioned shooting a 30-30 a number of times for deer. What's your favorite bullet weight, 150 or 170?
150.
150?
Yep.
Same here.
Yep, 150 for sure.
Tell you how long it's been since I've shot a deer with a 30-30. I was using 150 grain Winchester silver tips.
Really?
I don't even think they're made anymore.
I don't think they're either. That has been my go-to gun my whole life. And I hunt close quarters, you know, and in the woods, and it's a good brush gun, and it's mm-hmm. also just – it's been good to me. It's been so good to me, and it's got a lot of sentimental value. My mom actually bought that gun for my dad for their wedding gift, I think, is the way I understood it, which was before I was born. And then he gave it to me for my deer gun because I shot my first deer with it. He gave it to me when I was 15.
Well, I had a similar thing happen the very first time I went to shoot a deer. I Gosh, I didn't start deer hunting until after I got out of college. I grew up in a boot hill, and we didn't have deer back then. You'd hear somebody seeing a deer track, maybe on a sandbar on Mississippi River, and that was big news. But got in the Ozarks. An old gentleman at church actually loaned me a sporterized 03A3.
Oh, wow.
Had a scope on it and everything. Well, I went to a neighbor's farm, climbed up in a tree, didn't have a clue what I was doing. But what along, here come a 6 or 8 deer along doe. I'm going to shoot this doe. And, I mean, it's like a 20-yard shot. It's a gimme, right?
Yeah, you know? You think.
Click.
Oh, no.
But I did have a round in the chamber. It was a factory load that did not fire.
Oh,
and that deer ran off, and quickly I jacked another round. And another deer popped out behind a cedar tree. Well, I took that one home with me.
Yeah,
first try was a dud.
Yeah.
And yeah, you were talking about the old.
And that was the same shell? Same bullet?
No.
Oh, you jacked another one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Talking about the old A3 Springfield, though. That was a fine old rifle in its day.
Oh, yeah. I guess they were produced for what, World War One?
World War One, and they were actually even used some in World War Two.
Yeah, 500-yard rifles.
The Marine Corps used them.
Yeah.
That's a heck of a shot, 500 yards.
Oh, back in those days. But those guys spent, Jerry, how many, 13 weeks on the rifle range?
Yeah.
When I went through, we spent 4 weeks.
Yeah, more time than we did.
Yeah.
But, the Marine Corps got hand-me-down Army A303s.
Well, all the Marines need is clubs, right?
Yeah.
Let's don't start that one.
No, another can of worms.
Yeah, we'll have guys waiting on us at the door when we leave the studio.
Well, we've got we're winding down again, once again, to our – yeah, but, you know, okay, guess what, though? We still got one more segment. Wow. And in this last segment, I've been doing a lot of fishing lately. Matter of fact, I don't know if you missed it or not, Bill, but I caught a fish that would potentially won $100,000 just a month or so ago. I just caught it with Jack, you know, our good friend Jack Uxa.
Wow. He must have went click the first cast or something.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And then after that, and then also I just got off the water today. Like I told you, I've been fishing all day for smallmouth. It's pretty fun. So we caught some really nice smallmouth today. And it's been good fishing, crappie, smallmouth, largemouth, pretty much everything. Well, let's just talk a little bit of fishing this last
segment.
Sounds
good.
Everybody's fishing, just all in all. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with more in just 3 minutes. I'm Tommy Bench, and this is Wild at Heart.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back. I'm Tommy Bench, and you're listening to Wild at Heart. This is our last segment of the night, and we're talking about fishing. You know, just in general, I've been doing a lot of fishing here lately. Bass fishing, crappie fishing, smallmouth, largemouth, you name it. But we were just talking off air about I caught maybe my biggest largemouth ever on the lake here about last week. It was last week I caught it, and didn't have a scale. Of course, Jack, I asked him, I said, you're a guide on Lake of the Ozarks and you don't have a scale. It was in his boat. And his exact comment was, well, you know, if there's one of my clients is really looking forward to catching a bigger fish, and I'm ad-libbing this a little bit, and it may not be that quite that 5-pounder they've always dreamed about, but it may be a big 3 or a little 4. Nice 5-pounder. That's a good fish. You know, so happy client. Good to go. So anyway, all we could do is speculate, but I've caught a number of 5-pounders on that lake, including the Big Bass Bash, which I've taken checks in. I caught a 549. It got me a $700 check a couple springs ago. And anyway, this fish was head and shoulders literally above this fish. I mean, this was a 7-pounder, but it was amazing. It was the highlight of the last couple of weeks I've had, you know, biggest largemouth I've caught.
That's a big smallmouth.
Largemouth.
Largemouth, okay.
Yeah, it's largemouth. So, yeah, it's definitely a really nice largemouth. But, yeah, we I've been doing a lot of crappie fishing, trying to stock that freezer up, deer venison and crappie. We was talking about eating fish.
When are we going to eat?
Every weekend from May till October, I'm going to have a fish fry.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible? That's my goal. My goal is to sustain enough crappie to where I can have a fish fry every weekend if I want to from May through October. So
yeah, you were talking about the weather at the lake, it being cold and rainy and sleet and so on. That's when we fly fishermen like to go out and chase those big brown trout.
Yeah. Well, I know that us bass fishermen will also say the nasty weather brings out the big girls, you know, and
exactly.
That's usually when you catch the biggest fish. So we like it. We do, and it's tough, and some of the most diehard, you know, like yourself and Bill and these people that are getting out there when you got temperatures in the teens and nasty and 20, whatever it is. Most people are the fair weather fishermen, so to speak. Say, man, it's just too day. I ain't doing that. I'll wait till it warms back up in the springtime. You know, you're missing out.
Well, they can go catch the little fish. We'll catch the big ones
there
in the wintertime.
Well, all the smallmouth fishermen know, too, that cold weather, boy, is going to be the time you're going to catch your biggest fish of the year.
That's right.
Because all the good smallmouth fishermen know where they go.
That's right. And if you know where they go, it's pretty amazing. Just like today, for example, I was fishing with my good buddy Zach Feeler, and we were catching them. I mean, it was a fun day, and he was talking. You know, you do that as you talk. He said, "So what was that biggest one you caught again?" And he goes, "When was it caught?" I said, "It was this funny. I tell you, I remember everything about fishing. December 17th, 2007, roughly around 3:54 p.m. give or take a minute or two." So he kind of chuckled too, and he asked how big it was. I told him, I said, "Well, that fish never went back in the water. I kind of regret it." But I was talking about, we was talking about cameras earlier. I had just got back from Lake Fork, Texas, and I had been taking pictures with my Kodak digital camera, that what you guys call a
point and shoot.
Well, it locked up, like literally towards the end of the trip. It locked up. It just locked. It would not go on. It just shut off, and it would not come back on. Well, it had a warranty, so I sent it back to Kodak. That was before all the nice cell phone cameras had come out. This is 11, 12 years ago, I guess, 11. Anyway, had no way to get this picture. I mean, a fish of a lifetime, 23 and a quarter inches long, smallmouth. I mean, an absolute hammer of a smallmouth.
Wow.
All I had was a five-gallon bucket, because back then we'd get lucky. We'd get into some crappie or some goggle eye in this winter hole. And so, and that's what it was, December 17th, winter hole. I said, there is no way I can let this fish without not being able to have a picture of this. This is literally the biggest smallmouth I am going to ever catch in my entire lifetime. Well, you don't know that. Well, I'm not taking a chance on it. So I put it in a five-gallon bucket with river water, take my frog tog, pants over, you know, the little lip around the five-gallon bucket, seal that as tight as I can, tie it in like 16 knots, and then take the legs and wrap it over basically to where it won't slosh out of the bucket. It stays in the bucket. The frog togs are waterproof. I'm flying to my brother's house. When I get there, it's wintertime, so it gets dark, 5:30. I get there. My brother's out in his garage working. I'm running. James, he goes, "What's wrong?" I was like, "You got to see this fish. I need a camera, and I need to get this fish back in the water now." He goes, "What fish?" And I said, "What is it?" I said, "A smallmouth." "How big is it?" I said, "It's over 5 pounds." He said, "There's no way. There's no way it's impossible." I said, "No, you got to see this fish." And so we pull it out. He gets his digital camera. And we start taking pictures. It's funny because these pictures, if you ever see them, they're in his living room. So we're sitting in the living room with the smallmouth, taking another bucket.
Dan, you were talking about background.
Yeah,
earlier.
Right. Yeah.
But that's exactly what I was talking about.
With the deer head in the background, you know, on the wall. It was so big. His son was only like 3 or 4 years old at the time, a toddler. He started crying, just bawling because his fish was so big it scared him. It was just a big. That's not normal.
You know. Meanie?
Oh, man, it was huge. So, and then, you know, just to let you know, like Bill just said, wintertime is truly a time to catch giant fish, especially for smallmouth in the wintertime. And that is still, to date, the biggest smallmouth I've ever caught.
Well, I'm going to give away a secret spot, Tommy, so I'd keep them off of your spots. Is that good?
Yeah, I want you to.
That's
good.
Keep them off. Well, just this week, a couple of days ago, I was out at Merrimack Spring Park. Everybody knows Merrimack Spring. The winter trout fishing program is going on out there, but I went with a couple things in mind. I want to catch a few trout just for fun, but I caught more smallmouth than trout because what happens is those fish come for many, 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 many miles downriver to come up into that warmer water in a spring branch. And, boys, there are some nice smallmouth in the Merrimack Spring Park right now.
Wow.
And I'm talking some fish, you know, four, maybe better category.
That's good.
And those are worth catching. And things you can catch them on there, a good old hair jig.
Hair jigs, yeah.
Works as good classic, as anything.
Classic wintertime bait.
Exactly, and fish them on the bottom. And I actually just take an old eighth-ounce jig head of any kind, and I like to use hair off of a fox squirrel tail.
Fox squirrel,
reddish,
yeah.
Mottled. Mm-hmm. It looks a lot like a crayfish, and Tommy, it works like a charm.
Oh,
I was
going
to ask you, crayfish patterns would work
exactly,
well on that.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, there's going to be some guys kick me in the kneecaps for telling this, but
I'll protect you.
Thank you.
Is there any hard baits you can use with treble hooks further on?
You cannot
down?
Use any.
No.
Can't use any treble hooks in the park right now.
You can or cannot?
Cannot. It's got to be a single hook.
Single hook.
Now,
that's
you,
important.
Yeah, now
people
if you get out in the river, there's some holes down river that hold some smallmouth as well. So yeah. You can use your treble hooks down there.
I was just curious because I know a couple of baits that I like using in the wintertime that have treble hooks on them. But I knew that if you went below the park, I think, isn't that bridge? The little.
Well, yeah, that's not the line. The line's a few yards below that below bridge. That. But there's big signs to
there's
let you know
sign, yeah.
where
yeah.
you can
yeah.
start fishing.
Okay.
But yeah, there's some good smallmouth. In the river still.
And see, I would
but
be
they're
throwing,
stacked in the Merrimack Spring Branch.
I would be throwing a streamer in crayfish color there.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, probably an articulated streamer.
Well, I wasn't going to say it, but you did. You know?
In fact, Jerry, I don't know if I told you, but your many articulateds,
mm-hmm.
they worked well in the river the other day.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm going to have to go down there or up there.
Oh, it's such an interesting fishery. Well, I went the other day. It was a Tuesday. Went downriver, never saw another person, had it totally to myself. And that happens fairly often during the week. Weekend, you're going to get some folks down
there.
But,
crowds,
but
yeah.
I remember late last spring, I went down river, got an itch to go on a Saturday morning. I just had to go fishing. I could have gone all week, but I went on Saturday morning, and I made it to the bridge there and looked downriver. I could see 8 fishermen. Downstream, I thought, oh, this is not going to be good, but I'm going anyway. I just need to feel the tug on the line. You
yeah.
know? I walked past those 8 guys, and they were all within 250 yards of the bridge. Walked past those guys. I caught 69 trout in 4 hours and never saw another person downriver.
Wow.
Lots of people do not walk that far from the park. Now, you get some of the young guys that may go a mile or two downriver. But
is that down by Dry Creek or
Dry Fork? Yeah. Exactly between the park and Dry Fork.
Mm-hmm.
I caught a nice brown. nice for me because I'm not a trout fisherman, and I very rarely fish water that even holds trout.
Yeah.
But I went way down past like you were talking about. I didn't even know where I was at. I just know I kept walking.
Well, I was doing so well. It was one of those dark, kind of snowy, windy days. Great for brown trout. Throwing a small, thin gold spoon. The browns were just tearing it up. Sun popped out. The browns all run and hid.
They were done.
Yeah. So I broke out one of those hair jigs, bumped along the bottom, and the rainbows tore it up. And I got to tell you, Tommy, I wasted the last 30, 40 minutes of my trip because I'd caught 59 trout, and I was trying to make it number 60 just for a good round number. Fished the last 40 minutes trying, and all I caught was a smallmouth.
Oh, that's a shame.
I did get 60 fish, but 59 trout and one smallmouth. But in 4 hours of fishing, how often can you do that?
Not very
But you
often.
Know, Bill, something you mentioned there, though, and you're correct, there's not many people that want to go past that one gravel bar on down to Dry Fork Creek there. And that's where some of the best fishing is, in that stretch of river, actually.
Oh, it's good fishing, but it's just amazing how many fish there are in those holes between Merrimack Spring Park and the Dry Fork down there. But you can go all the way down the Scotch Ford, and you're going to catch fish all the way if you know how to fish the river. And there's trout below Scotch Ford. I've caught some dandies on down. I've got further down river, but tremendous fishery there. And hey, another piece of information: just last week, they threw several thousand more trout in Merrimack Spring Park. So fish are stacked. The water's been up right now, but gets back to where you can sight fish. It's good.
Well. What an amazing show again here at Wild at Heart. And we're wrapped up to the last, like we've always said, it just burns on by. But Wild at Heart is heard every Wednesday afternoon from 4 to 6 and Sunday morning from 8 to 10. The show is produced in the studios of ESPN 107.3 in Rollitt, engineered by John Francis. We'd like to thank our guests today, Justin Travis, Josh Cornelison, Diane and Bill Cooper. And don't forget, you can always listen to the podcast on this show. Just go to our website at ESPN1073.com. Click Programming, Wild at Heart. I'm Tommy Bench.
And I'm Jerry Cook.
Thanks for joining us. Perfect. I did say that right.
Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3. Powered by Cowtown USA, Colton Steakhouse and Grill, J. Cook Fly Rods, The Outdoor Superstore, Advanced Performance Shooting, Missouri Trappers Association, and Trout and Sons. Hear the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond. Wild at Heart, 4 p.m. Wednesdays and 8 a.m. Sundays on ESPN 107.3.